I've been thinking for some time about how our brains and souls process all the media messaging hurled at us on all our devices. Actually, for about 25 years, I've been fond of the practice known as media literacy as a tool to help us maintain our inner peace and allow media to help us not harm our psyches and our souls so we don't lose our ability to keep peace with ourselves and make it with others. One of my first encounters with someone who was actively preaching the value of media literacy was media and communication professor Dr. Rob Williams, now at the University of Vermont, and he's with us online there from his porch. Hello, Rob.
Paul, it's great to hear your voice.
It's wonderful to hear you too, and I knew Rob when he was teaching an at-the-time innovative media literacy course in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where our Peace Talks World headquarters is. And that was back in the late 1990s. I was excited about it then and still now. Rob is also a consultant, a musician, and an author. He wrote The Post-Truth World about fake news, real journalism, and what he calls the Chomsky-Herman propaganda model, updated for the digital age, and we'll be talking about that shortly. But Rob, I'm going to start with offering you a softball question to see if you buy my premise that personal peace and peace between us can be well served by mastering media literacy skills. In broad terms, how so, do you think?
I think that you are absolutely right about that, Paul. I think communication between humans, between us sapiens, is one of the most important elements that make us human. And so clear and honest and transparent communication is truly a species-wide survival and thrival mechanism. So to get communications right is truly an imperative for us as a species, not to mention us as individuals.
Mm-hmm. I do want to talk about best practices for consuming news and parsing out real journalism from what has come to be known as fake news. But actually, I wanted to start, though, with preserving our peace of mind in the face of advertising. And I want to reference a song I'm sure you know, Jackson Browne's famous song, The Pretender. There's a stanza in there that goes, "I'm going to be a happy idiot and struggle for the legal tender, where the ads take aim and lay their claim to the heart and the soul of the spender. And believe in whatever may lie in those things that money can buy. Thought true love could have been a contender. Are you there? Say a prayer for the pretender." And that was 1976, I think. So maybe even earlier than that song came out. But how does advertising, particularly television advertising, encroach on our desire to live a peaceful existence, do you think? Because I remember watching you and our late friend Bob McCannon do lectures for high school kids, having them deconstruct commercials so that they can kind of put their shields up against, you know, all kinds of between the lines messaging that was being hurled at them.
Well, first of all, I love the Jackson Browne lyric. Thanks for having. Reminds me I have to go back and listen. So Jackson Browne wrote that song, recorded that song in 1976, which interestingly is the same year that Paddy Chayefsky's famous film Network was released. And that might be the single best movie ever made about the television business as an industry. And it was where my mind went when you referenced that song. But to your question, so much has changed since Jackson Browne penned that lyric in 76. And in a word, you know, what has changed? The internet. The internet has arrived. And with it, the digital age. And with the digital age, a complete kind of reorientation of the nature of advertising and the nature of propaganda and the nature of what we call news in our hyper-mediated digital 21st century culture. So, you know, in some ways, as I listen to your question, I think about the answer to it. The idea of sort of inoculating ourselves against a 30-second television advertisement seems sort of quaint because we're now so enmeshed in our new digital communications universe And one of the first rules of critical media literacy education is to recognize the trade-offs inherent in any media system. There are always good things that happen. There are always bad things that happen in any media experience. And a media literate person, a media literate citizen, will understand both the goods and the bads and be able to kind of weigh the costs and benefits of that experience. So certainly the internet gives and the internet takes away. And bringing that back around to your original question, if we as humans, as individuals, are to find peace of mind in our 21st century digital age, we must daily reckon with our relationship with this thing called the internet and our digital age.
Well, and I do want to get there about that. I guess I still live, and I think that maybe, I don't know, maybe I'm a dinosaur, but I think that maybe if you're 40 or over, you might still be tied to kind of the old school impact of television advertising. So humor me for a moment by talking about that a little bit, which is probably going back to your 1999 lectures. But
sure. Well, I'm happy, but, happy to go there. You know, yeah. I think statistically that, and that most Americans still get most, if not all, of their news, for example, from television.
You know, I am one of those guys that tries to watch the 5 o'clock evening news here. And I am a hypercritic. So, you know, everybody has to forgive me for that. But for example, you know, I was watching NBC Nightly News last night and taking notes. And this is typical formatting for a evening newscast, is that you get 14, 15 minutes of news, and then they take a break. They do a 1 minute commercial now, I'm noticing. But anyway, in the back half of that newscast, there's 90 seconds, maybe 2 minutes of newscasting, and the rest is commercials. And the number of commercials is like 17, because most commercial units now are 15 seconds. And so I talk with people about this topic and they say, oh, advertising doesn't affect me. I don't even hear it anymore. I tune it out. And they'll excuse that. They'll excuse it as in, you know, I understand that if it weren't for the advertising, I wouldn't get to see any of my favorite news or shows, quote, for free. But I want to go to sort of the basic idea that it's important for us to know it's not for free if we're giving it any attention at all, if the advertising is making any noise in our life at all. And that's the exchange that you were talking about a moment ago, I think. You know, what makes it a transaction of something valuable that we own or should take more ownership of, which is our attention, which I think, you know, everything that you talk about and we are going to talk about the infusion of the internet is important. But I think we can even boil it down further upstream to this matter of our attention, which I don't think people talk about it much.
Yeah, there's a wonderful phrase out there in the world of media literacy. The phrase is the attention merchants. The attention merchants. I always like that because you're right. There's some very powerful corporate commercial interests and state-sponsored interests who are competing for what they sometimes call mind share, literally kind of attempts to colonize our minds. And the more we can be critically self-aware, the more powerful we are vis-a-vis those very powerful messages and stories that come to us ubiquitously, it seems, on our screens. And yeah, let's start with a legacy analog media model. So there's a couple of things to be aware of. One is when you're watching television, those moving images are processed by our limbic emotional feeling brains. We've all heard the expression, a picture is worth 1,000 words. A picture is worth 1,000 words. Why is that? Because pictures are processed in our emotional brains. We think about pictures differently than we think about words on a page, in a book, or even on a screen, let's say. So when we're watching television news, to use your example, or television advertisements, we think we're invulnerable, but when we think that, the truth is we're actually most vulnerable because we aren't approaching that experience critically. We're letting our limbic, emotional, feeling brain carry the load rather than our neocortical, thinking, irrational brain. And so much of what comes across the TV airwaves now, and I notice this quite a bit when I travel because I don't live with the television, but I, you know, the TVs are on ubiquitously in the airports now, for example, in hotel rooms and people's homes. And and you mentioned this earlier, Paul, the speed with which everything has been kind of ramped up and the emotional intensity that accompanies that speed is really noticeable to me as someone who thinks about and teaches this stuff for a living and tries to build a little distance between myself and those experiences when I'm home.
Well, I think that's why, just to interject quickly, I think that that's why, you know, advertising, television advertising has gotten so extreme is the word you could use, you know, in 15 seconds, everything is overacted, emotionalized. It looks crazy, but it's because they're trying to deliver a gut punch in 15 seconds that is resulted with a name brand that you start to associate with something that cures the emotional gut punch, if you will.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, to bring us back to those 1999 lectures, I love that. You know, there's a couple of questions to answer. One is, you know, what reality, quote unquote, is being constructed by this commercial or this TV news program? What reality is being constructed? Number two, what production techniques are they using? We've just mentioned a couple there to construct that reality. And number three, what emotions are being cultivated and transferred from that TV news show or that TV commercial, that advertisement? What emotions are being transferred into the mind and the heart and, dare I say, the soul of the user? And we're talking about sort of thousands of media messages, if we factor in the internet as well, thousands of media messages a day we're marinating in, you know, 10 to 12 hours a day on average consuming media through our more and more ubiquitous screens. So think about reality construction, think about production techniques, think about emotional transfer. And then think about that question of trade-offs. You know, what are the goods here? What are the bads here? And on balance, is this cost-benefit analysis really worth my time, my energy, my money? And you begin to sort of get a sense of just how powerful a toolbox critical media literacy education can be when you're confronted with literally the most powerful media culture we've ever created in human civilization.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the reason for sketching out that outline of the NBC News, you know, we like to talk about solutions here. And so, you know, if any of this concerns you, you know, I don't think that people necessarily recognize that the back half of a nightly newscast is 17 commercials, 3 minutes of news. And so, okay, so maybe the easiest way to confront that is to say, all right, I'm going to turn the TV off after 15 minutes because there's not much left for me here, right? I mean, some people, and I make active use of the mute button, but, you know, I don't want to go down this rabbit hole either, but commercial advertising has completely figured out a way to overcome the mute button by just showing images and putting up the stuff on the screen. And as you say, it's, you know, they've figured all that out. So so that's not necessarily a protection, although it's some protection. And there are ways to cut yourself off from that that some people don't think of because they just routinely leave the television on or leave the sound on.
You're right. And I'm really struck by how many people use the television as kind of sonic wallpaper.
Right, right. People who live alone do that a lot. And there's some comfort even in the commercials that there are people talking. I've heard people say that. I just like having the TV on because it makes me feel, you know, less anxious about being alone. You know, some people who aren't into Buddhist meditation, for example, don't want to be quiet for a moment, but it scares them. So that's one reason for it.
Well, that's right. And I have a lot of younger friends who will say that as well. And I think that tendency to want to avoid quiet and solitude and critical self-introspection, whatever you want to call it, I think that certainly bleeds heavily over into the world of the internet as well. It's why people, you know, use their mobile devices the way they do. They need that constant stimulation and that distraction from the present moment.
Well, before we leave TV for here in a moment, I do want to get to the other stuff. But having been a journalist myself, worked in television news for some time, I guess I've been hyper aware of, you know, there is value in good TV news journalism, and I have a lot of friends in it, and I know they're doing good work. But when I watch a typical newscast, you know, I'm overwhelmed by the kind of the bleeds it leads, the worst story in the world, the worst list of things that are happening in the world, followed by one feel-good moment. I mean, that convention has been used for so many years, it amazes me that nothing has changed about it. And then I wanted to explore what's the research about this business of a program that gives you mostly bad news and then is infused with advertising that is supposed to offer you some relief of some kind to some part of your misery. You know, the meta message of news programming, 24/7 news programming, the idea of the main purpose, along with good journalism, of any news organization or news broadcast is to make you keep watching. These are things that I think, you know, deserve a little bit of consciousness space in our brains when we are consuming that I don't think a lot of people are thinking about.
I would agree. You just put your finger on sort of the analog television business model there, Paul. We deliver some really bad news. We intersperse that really bad news with product-oriented or service-oriented solutions to help you mitigate the bad news, whether it's the latest pharmaceutical product or an automobile that will allow you to drive away from your problems or a beer that will intoxicate you enough to sort of drown your sorrows perhaps for just a little while. And we put all that together in a very powerful package that combines, you know, news, infotainment with this commercial sales pitch over and over and over again. And you're right, it's a very cliched paradigm, but it seems like it's still in use. And evidently, it must be working enough for both the newscasters and the corporate commercial advertising partners of those news channels to be continually embracing it.
Do you think there's a way that we can hold in our brains these two thoughts about recognizing that news programs do want us to watch? I mean, when stories about war or the pandemic of 2020 come in, you know, there's it tends to feed this skepticism about the value of good journalism in our world, because there's this idea that that they're overhyping it, you know, that they're taking that, they're making you want to, making you try to keep watching, get the latest, you know, breaking news, the even frantic vocalization of most of the anchors, all of that stuff is part of the product, and yet inside of that is this tradition of actual good journalism. How do we separate all that out and separate the wheat from the chaff, do you think?
So I've written about this in the post-truth world. I see six elements that comprise a real news story as opposed to, let's say, fake news. And if we can train ourselves, and it's not very hard to do this, if we can train ourselves to recognize real news and sort of talk back or think back at, if you will, our screens, that will give us more power as news and information consumers vis-a-vis this very powerful image-driven, dare I say, propaganda that we're kind of marinating find ourselves marinating in. So I like the where you're going with this. And I think it really does begin with sharpening our critical awareness about the stories that we are being that are being put in front of us.
What I hear you saying is that the model that we're talking about here is being able to say, okay, I'm noticing this newscaster's hyper excitement. I'm noticing the blaring graphics. I'm noticing them saying, you have to stay around to watch this next story, a story that every family should see. I hear Lester Holt say that all the time. Okay, I understand what they're doing there. I don't have to believe that part of it, but I'm going to stick around for Richard Engel's incredible reporting because I know he's a serious journalist, right? There's a place that we can occupy, right, where we can do all that, and that's where media literacy and awareness comes in. Is that, that's my hopeful statement of purpose.
Yeah, no, that's right. And I'll give you an example of, I think, what we're talking about here. You mentioned the COVID-19 pandemic. My brother in Florida sends me a screenshot every day of his giant flat screen television and the CNN news feed. And just because I asked him to, right, just as sort of a fun daily conversation between the two of us. And the COVID-19 story is illustrative because what you get on the television are those blaring graphics. We see the numbers constantly going up, as you would rationally expect with any seasonal or yearly annual pandemic. The numbers go up, then the numbers tail off, right? That's the way a pandemic works every year, right? But it's so sort of hyped. The numbers are so hyped and they're also decontextualized, right? So there's no sense from Lester Holt or any of the news anchors that, let's put these numbers in context for you, right? Based on the latest epidemiological stories that we're reporting on or the latest science that we're discovering here in conversation with, or any of that. It's mostly about the numbers and deriving those clicks and those shares and those views and that that mind share by using as many powerful production techniques and as many powerful emotional pitches as possible.
Right. Well, and we could keep going on about pet peeves. I'll just throw one more in before we move on. But in election coverage, the use of polls, it always bothers me when they show a poll between presidential candidates and they put in the smallest, if they put it up at all, they put in the smallest font size, the margin of error. And the margin of error on a lot of these polls is somewhere around 4 to 5%. So that if you're saying, let's just talk about 2020 Democratic primary candidates, you know, if you're saying Joe Biden is, you know, 25% and Bernie Sanders is 23%, what they really should be putting is, you know, 22 to 27% for Biden, you know, 20 to 26% for Sanders. To know that nobody's leading this poll, really, but they don't go there because they're wanting to report a horse race that gives Biden followers some excitement because their man's in front, gets Sanders people worked up because their man's not. And it's, that's where I think, as much as I hate the term fake news, you have an example of something that is not real. It's not being reported in the real way just by putting in font, tiny font what the margin of error is and usually not even mentioning that there is a margin of error as they're reporting it.
You're absolutely right. It's all about the horse race. And again, as with the COVID situation, with election coverage, we're decontextualizing the data rather than putting it into context of a larger narrative because the horse race keeps driving that 24/7 need that our news, quote unquote, channels have in the digital age of filling the news hole, right? So every new poll is an opportunity to fill the news hole.
Yeah. Rob Williams from the University of Vermont is online with us from Vermont. And this is Peace Talks Radio. Rob, I have known for many years as a leader in media literacy and communication studies. If I were to watch you do a media literacy class for young people now, I'm sure there would be a lot of talk about social media, and you were bending us there before I went analog and mono with you before. I feel like the old Phil Spector back to mono button should be plastered on my head. So what's the important thing for us to know for what we think of as a free platform like Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, other apps that we are giving up these? What are we giving up to these services that can be used to compromise our personal peace of mind and how we keep peace with others that we're tending to overlook?
Great question. So anytime a for-profit corporate commercial communications entity approaches you and says, we're going to give you some free stuff, right? We're going to give you free access to Facebook or free access to a blog platform or free access to Snapchat or TikTok or whatever it may be, immediately start waving the red flag. Because really what's happening is that we become the product in that so-called free transaction. And what I mean by that is when we cozy up to for-profit corporate commercial social media platforms and we're invited to quote-unquote share information with our quote-unquote friends online, to use two of Mark Zuckerberg's favorite words, share and friend, what we're essentially doing is giving over more and more of our own personal stories in the form of digital data to those for-profit corporations, who then turn around and do a couple things with it. They sort it, they store it, they aggregate it. They use it to pitch us products and services we may or may not want. They use it to figure out how we're networked in with other like or unlike-minded individuals and organizations. And all of that is done in the name of free. So rarely do we read what is called the EULA, the End User License Agreement, which we are presented with in long, convoluted legalese every time we put a new social media app on our phone and we're asked to accept the EULA. And we do, mostly without question, because we want to get on with the business, literally the business, of Snapchatting or Facebooking or tweeting or whatever. So that's the bargain that we make as social media users when we create accounts on these social media platforms. We talk about them. It's funny, Paul. We talk about them as if they're ours. Oh, you know, my Facebook page, you know, on my Snapchat. It's like, no, you're leasing that space, actually. Leasing that space from Facebook or Snapchat in return for a steady stream of digital data that, by the way, is getting more and more sophisticated by the week.
So what is the threat to our inner peace or our ability to make peace in the world, do you think? Because and the reason I ask that is because I think it turns on the same thing that I mentioned earlier about people and how they think about TV advertising. They say it doesn't affect me. I've heard people say, well, I love Facebook so much. I love what it gives me, and I've got nothing to hide. I don't care what they do with my preferences.
Yeah, you hear that a lot. And you just have to look at the CEOs of these large corporations who, A, don't let their own children anywhere near these platforms, and B, do everything they can to protect their own privacy, to know that we should be suspicious or at least aware of what's happening with our data. So to your first question, so I believe that each of us are unique and sovereign individuals. And to cultivate peace of mind, this is Peace Talks Radio, to cultivate peace of mind, we need a healthy sense of ourselves and a healthy sense of our place in the world and how we make meaning of our lives. And I think what happens too often with so-called social media, a couple things. One is social media can be very isolating. We've all are well-versed in individuals with social media platforms on their mobile devices who in social situations are much more interested in being on these social media platforms than being present in face-to-face social encounters. So let's start there. There's a new term making the rounds. I love it. It's called fubbing. When you and I, Paul, are having a conversation and I, in the middle of our conversation, pick up my phone and ignore you, I've just fubbed you. That's P-H-U-B, fub. So you've just been fubbed. And that happens all the time, right? It happens in people's private living rooms all the time amongst, intimate friends and family members. So So fubbing is a reality, right? But the other more insidious thing, back to the data transfer, and I want to reference a brilliant new book called The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, 8 years in the making by a woman at Harvard University in the business school. Her name is Shoshana Zuboff. She has a brilliant verb to describe what happens in this situation. The verb is render. And she uses the word render in two ways. First of all, when we're on these social media platforms, we are rendering over the intimate details of our lives in digital codes of digital binary codes of ones and zeros. We're rendering over the moment by moment details of our personal flesh and blood lives to these companies. And what these companies do, render in the second sense, is they render, they chop up, as if you were throwing a beef cow into a slaughterhouse, they chop up or render our very human experiences, chop them up into these binary codes of digital data, these data points they can then use to sell us back what we say we want, or give over these data points to other for-profit third-party providers and companies that will run and governments, let's be clear, that can take this information and do with it what they will. So we're experience the rendering of our very humanness in those two ways. We give over ourselves, and ourselves are rendered digitally, and then these companies chop up, they render our digital selves for the purpose not just of selling back to us, but of also, and this is what Shoshana Zuboff talks about so brilliantly in this book, also the goal is the creation of predictive behavioral futures markets. If Facebook, for example, can predict the collective future behavior of a swath of its 2 billion plus users online, that gives Facebook tremendous power over us flesh and blood humans over the long haul. And that's a really sophisticated concept. And I wake up every morning thinking about it, because it's a really brilliant insight that Zuboff gives us when she talks about predictive behavioral futures markets. It's not just about the digitizing of us as individuals and the rendering of us as individuals, but it's also about the collective, if you will. So we as a species, as well as we as individuals, have to contend with the pros and cons of this very strange relationship with these companies and with these governments.
Right. And you sent me your book review of that amazing book and some excerpts from it. And I think of what you were saying, the thing that got me thinking the most was this predictive element. I think somewhere within the synopsis, she's talking about when we lose our ability to be unpredictable, then we're losing something very important about our experience of living and the possibilities of our life. If everything is kind of anchored to our existing preferences, and that they know what flips our trigger, and our trigger keeps getting flipped, then we don't have a moment, a quiet moment, as we were talking earlier, to think about, well, do I really want that? Is that really what makes me happy? And it takes a little bit away of our will to make a different choice. Is that extending it out a little too far, or is that in fact exactly what she's saying?
I think you said that really brilliantly, Paul. I think that is what she's saying. And to put it in the language of human rights for a moment, if I may, just to piggyback on what you've just said, Zuboff in this book, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, she lays out three human rights of the digital age that we should all contend with. Number one, and most obviously, is the right to privacy. As human beings, we should fight for and pursue the right to privacy, because it gives us those quiet, contemplative spaces of solitude in which we can cultivate a certain sensibility about ourselves and our possible future selves, to be Jungian about it for just a minute, right? The less privacy we have, the less opportunity we have to really kind of meditate on who we are and what we might, or who we might become. So we hear a lot about privacy in a narrow sense, I think, but philosophically and sort of, you know, at a species-wide level, we really, and it's one of the West's great inventions, I think, is the right to privacy, right? We need that. The second right she talks about is the right to be forgotten. And the illustration of this is, well, let me give you an example. If I commit a crime and I do my jail time, I pay my fine, I do my community service, I remand myself back into polite society after doing my time. But this crime follows me around the internet for the rest of my life. So I'm in a job interview 25 years later, and up comes some story about, oh yeah, Williams committed this crime 25 years ago. We can't hire him. That is an incredible sort of burden to bear. And all of us as humans, of course, make mistakes all the time. So the right to be forgotten is this idea, and the European Union is kind of beginning to pass some legislation around this now. The right to be forgotten is requiring these digital media companies to let go of our past mistakes online, just as we do in the real world. And then finally, the third right, and it's a powerful one, is, and this gets to your point of earlier, what she calls the right to a future tense, the right to a future tense, the right for us as human individuals to determine our own destinies, independent of being nudged or steered or predictively programmed by these more and more sophisticated algorithms that know our digital selves more intimately by the day. And to bring us back to your point about peace and our own inner struggle as humans, we do ourselves no favors if we don't distance ourselves from our devices and from our screens and from these platforms on a regular basis, by which I mean daily. We need to create sanctuaries. We need to create refuges for ourselves daily to give ourselves space from this very powerful technology.
Right. There are two things at odds there. I think that I'll just say Facebook, or all of them are the same, you know, Instagram, Twitter, whatever. They seem to have been built on a innate need to be seen, need to be heard, need to be recognized, need to have your own broadcast channel. I'm very susceptible to all this, I know, because I'm a broadcaster, and you know, I used to be on the radio every day in the morning talking about what's going on in the world. And so Facebook is very alluring to me, because even though I don't have that specific kind of job anymore, I can go and post my thoughts on last night's newscast or today's news or whatever, or the cool video that I just saw. You know, and I have an audience, even if it's just 100 people who are following me, that's very powerful. So a couple of thoughts coming up in what you were just saying is that, you know, there's that against understanding that there is a need to be forgotten, a need to be private, that we probably aren't recognizing against that very compelling pull to be public and to be seen and to be heard. So there's that. And then the other thing that comes to mind, too, is that, and I'm going to use another now archaic reference, because I still love my iPod Classic. But when I first started using my iPod and people started loading their favorite music onto their little portable things, and they could walk around with 10,000 of their favorite songs in their pocket, I heard one person respond to it by saying, basically what you're doing is creating a gated community of your experience of music. You know, you're taking all your favorites and you're not listening to new music anymore. And so there's a danger, I think, in being defined by our likes, if you will. And there's not just that, not just the possibility of protecting ourselves from new experience, but there's sort of a cordoning off. And you can even see this to some degree in Facebook's latest advertising about joining groups of like-minded people. I think Facebook is perfectly happy to promote the idea of us just being, spending a lot of time in groups of like-minded people, doing our favorite things, exploring our favorite stuff. And then we ask, well, why are we so polarized politically? It's because, you know, we've got these platforms that are just not really inviting us to learn what the other side is feeling or doing. And I think that, you know, the political era of the 2016 election and where we've been ever since, and the way that these platforms have been the target for polarizing advertising, and this gets into your fake news area even more, which we spent precious little time talking about, is the underpinning of what's going on with these things that we need to be conscious of. We have to be at least aware of it.
It's brilliantly said, Paul, and you're putting your finger on something that's so important and central to understanding our digital age in the United States, and it's very little talked about, and that is the programmed polarization of citizens in this country into like-minded camps. You and I are both big fans of true community media, right? And in a community, you are pushed to wrestle with other individuals and groups of people who have different ways of doing things and different perspectives on things and different ideas about how the world looks and where it should go. And that's beautiful.
Like a classic New England town meeting, in other words.
I was just going to say, I attend every year, and I'm a big fan, because that's when you really see the breadth and depth of your neighbors and the people who live in your town or in your city. And what's happening online, Paul, and you nailed it, is we're being programmed into tribes. And I'll give you an example. When you go onto YouTube and you search for a Donald Trump video or a Bernie Sanders video and you watch it, rather than YouTube saying, hey, we see you like Donald Trump, here's another point of view, what do you get on YouTube? You get more extreme versions of Donald Trump, or you get more extreme versions of Bernie Sanders. And literally with every video you watch, right, you go down a particular filter bubbled rabbit hole, rather than saying, you know, there's a lot of different ways to think about this particular question or this particular issue. And that is done by design, right? It's the second largest search engine in the world behind Google, which is interesting. And you also see it in the legacy media, right? MSNBC, Rachel Maddow, and Chris Hayes are going to serve you up anti-Trump propaganda 24/7. We're over on Fox, are going to serve you up pro-Trump propaganda 24/7. And never the twain shall meet, except when on occasion you might get a Bernie Sanders on Fox, or you might get a Donald Trump. It's never happened on MSNBC, I don't think. But point being, these legacy TV news channels have figured out that polarization is a way better business model in the short term than community or genuine sort of debate and discourse. And it is killing this very fragile republic, just to be political for a minute, right? Fox invented this, by the way. Fox invented this technique, but I'll tell you, all of the TV news outlets, CNN, MSNBC, Fox, they're all doing it now. And it's really, it's really sad. It's really about the bottom line for them.
So when you were using Fox and MSNBC as an example, you talked about the MSNBC shows, Rachel Maddow, Chris Hayes, and you immediately said, they're going to give you propaganda. And I know MSNBC followers would say, wait a minute, that's some of the best journalism that's going on. They're quoting New York Times. They're just reporting what's doing. They're playing this valuable watchdog role. And they will argue vehemently that in that case, in that example, and the Fox people would do the opposite probably, but they would say, that's the journalism. That's the fake news. And so how do we, whichever camp we're in, this gets probably back to your six steps. You know, how do we parse out what those programs are doing, because you've actually described, and we were talking about earlier, that the news organizations, they may be under the veneer of news reporting. They may be actually trying to give you solid news reporting. And again, I know folks that work for those companies, and they are out there trying to get the news in an old school way. But the packaging is about getting your eyes and your attention for the advertisers. So they are creating this like-minded group, and they want everybody who's in that like-minded group to be watching them to be able to sell the advertising so that they can continue to do the journalism and the work. But it's put into, you know, a package that, as you suggest, bumps up, if not as mainstream, classifiable as propaganda. So how do we tell the difference, and how can we consume it from a place of awareness?
So the term fake news is a new term for really what is an old phenomenon, and that is the phenomenon of propaganda. Mm-hmm. And to be clear, what we mean by propaganda is simply one-sided information published to persuade, right? One-sided information published to persuade. So when Rachel Maddow goes on MSNBC for 3 years and flogs the Russia hacked the 2016 election story, which died a quiet death, by the way, when the U.S. government just dropped all of its charges against that internet troll farm outside of St. Petersburg about a month ago. To me, that was the biggest fake news story of the past 3 years, right? And I'm not picking on Rachel Maddow. She's brilliant, right? If you haven't read her book, Drift, about the United States as an imperial project, I mean, you know, clearly the woman is gifted intellectually. But the business model, as you said earlier, for all of these corporate commercial TV news outlets trumps, no pun intended, but trumps the desire, I think, to do real news. So let's talk about real news as opposed to fake news or propaganda. Real news has six elements. Number one, real news is storied information, right? We are sapiens for millennia. We have used stories to communicate important information, right? So real news is storied information that is, number one, recent, number two, relevant, which is to say it's news we can use, number three, it's reliable, which is to say it's transparently sourced. None of this like, well, sources said or authorities said or some unnamed person said. It's like, let's be clear about where the information's coming from, right? So recent, relevant, reliable. Number four, it's got a sense of historical context, right? Number five, it is what I like to say hegemonically hip, which is simply to say it foregrounds power relations. And number six, it is harmonious or has multiple points of view. So recent, relevant, reliable, historical, hegemonic, and harmonious. If a news story, a purported news story, doesn't meet those six simple criteria, then it is probably not a news story. And what I say to people is, rather than take your news faithfully on a channel by channel or a network by network or a personality by personality basis, oh, you know, Tucker Carlson always serves it up straight, or Rachel Maddow always serves it up straight, treat each news story on its own terms. And if you do this, and it requires a little bit more discernment, of course, a little bit more intellectual effort, of course, but this is the situation we find ourselves in, right? If you can think critically about news on a story-by-story basis, then we will be in much better shape than we are currently. And this is where critical media literacy really comes into play. Occasionally, the truth might come out of Tucker Carlson's mouth or Rachel Maddow's mouth or Chris Hayes's mouth or whoever. And there are really good journalists out there who are doing really good work. But a lot of what purports to be news, I think, is unfortunately more propagandistic. It's more one-sided. And we've talked about already why that is so from a corporate and sort of for-profit business perspective. I didn't mention the propaganda model of news yet, but let me mention that briefly. The propaganda model of news comes from Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman's 1988 book called Manufacturing Consent. the political economy of the mass media, manufacturing consent. And what we did was bring the propaganda model of news up to speed for the digital age. Chomsky and Herman wrote that book kind of as the internet was just kind of coming online in the late 80s. We're old enough, Paul, to remember that. But they never really had a chance to revise it. Edward Herman has passed 2 years ago. Noam Chomsky, I think, is closing in on 90, if he's not 90 already. So we spent about a year updating the propaganda model of news for the digital age. And that's where those six elements of a real news story came from.
And we'll have links to that on our website, too. What we're calling on all of us to do is as you said earlier, it's really hard, basically. It requires so much attention to what's coming at us, because in the examples that you gave, the first thing that comes to mind when you're absorbing stuff like that is that, for example, I don't like Hillary Clinton, so I want to believe that. I don't like Donald Trump. I want to believe that. So it totally undercuts it threatens to undercut all of the ability for you to do that 6-point checklist about where's the information coming from and why it's important to know what the source is, as opposed to a New York Times reporter citing unnamed sources high up in the Trump administration.
That's right. You're talking about confirmation bias. We tend to seek out news sources that confirm what we think to be true about the world. And the algorithms and the filter bubbles built into the internet reinforce our confirmation biases. And we are, as sapiens as well, we are inherently tribal. It's encoded deep in our genetic makeup, deep in our DNA. So all of this works, all of this conspires against stepping back and applying some critical thinking to news. You're right. It's a big lift, but I think we got to do it.
Yeah. Well, you suggested earlier, as we kind of wrap up here, giving yourself some distance from social media. You didn't say sign off of social media, I noticed. I had a friend last night, you know, on Facebook saying, I'm closing down on Facebook. I'm obviously she's concerned about these things. And I immediately texted her on the phone to make sure I had her phone number correct and say, I want to make sure that we can stay in touch. You know, what could we do? And I've heard some people say, you know, we could create an email list or something of people that we like to talk with. Brainstorm with me about some things for people who are rightfully concerned enough to say, I'm cutting myself off. I want my life back. I don't want to be so predictable, but I want to take some of the things that are good about social media and preserve that.
Sure. Right. So we humans have a natural human tendency to want to communicate. And there's a host of different ways to do that. We don't need to have social media, corporate commercial social media platforms be intermediaries necessarily. And I am a social media user. I'm pretty active on a couple of channels. I've quit Twitter. I'm thinking about quitting Facebook. I like Instagram because I like pictures. I appreciate how pictures work on our brains, as we talked about. But here's my biggest suggestion, Paul. Every one of us can buy fully a third of our daily lives back simply by buying what's called an alarm clock and using an alarm clock to wake us up in the morning rather than our mobile phones. And at night, every night, charge your mobile phone as far away from your bed and your head as possible. Neurophysiologically, that's really good for the brain to get those EMF waves, the blue light, all that stuff. Get it out of the bedroom, right? Let your brain have a hard kind of reset every night. Our brains need that to kind of repattern and rebuild and rest, right? But we also break the addictive cycle of constantly checking in on the news and checking our social media feeds by taking that big step. Go buy an alarm clock, take the alarm clock challenge, give it 2 weeks, see how you feel. It's hard. It's hard. Don't cuddle with your iPhone at night.
Yeah. And I've often thought about too, the business of, gosh, this will sound so old-fashioned, but was it 20, 25 years ago? Maybe you got to go back 30 years where you'd leave for the day and you would check your messages at night on your phone and you wouldn't have access to a phone. I'm thinking about going to lunch with a friend. Leave your phone at home for even 2 hours.
Yes. That's the second piece of advice. Yes, is get used to journeying detethered, as I like to say. Leave your phone at home. Third idea, and again, try it, right? And the third part of this approach is to condition your loved ones, your friends and family, not to expect you to immediately answer all the time when they reach out. It's like, I know a couple of families who have conditioned everyone around them to say, look, Friday night at 5 p.m., we're shutting off the router. We'll be back online Monday morning at 7. If you want to reach us, here's our landline, if it's an emergency, or stop by. But we're not going to be online this weekend. We're taking a social media, we're taking an internet Sabbath, an internet fast. And it takes a few weeks, you know, for people to figure this out, and you got to kind of let them know. Otherwise, they get worried. Oh, my gosh, they're dead in the house, because you haven't responded right away. But I think that is critical, establishing those places and times of refuge daily, beginning with a good night's sleep. If we can do that, we can still engage with the internet and social media, but have daily distance from it. And I think that's so critical.
Rob Williams, this has just been wonderful. Anything that I didn't ask you about that you kind of said to yourself, gosh, I really want to get into this conversation with Peace Talks Radio today, or to summarize?
One last thought, and you'll appreciate this, Paul. I think all of us should think of ourselves as human beings as in the business of storytelling. When we sing a song, we're telling a story. When we write a poem and perform it, we're telling a story. When we dance in the backyard under the moon, we're telling a story. So we've been so conditioned to think that we have to kind of let the professionals do our storytelling for us. And I think one of the great things about social media platforms is they do afford all of us the opportunity to be creative and to tell stories and to listen to the stories of others. And I think that's, you know, that's exciting. So if you can establish some balance there, but if everyone out there listening to this could think of themselves as storytellers and as listeners of others' stories, which again is a deeply human evolutionary impulse, we would be well served as a species.
But just to challenge that slightly is that we could do that as we all did for centuries before without these technological tools. And we seem to be afraid of not being able to use them to, you know, reach them or to use them in this sort of creative way. But we could create our own platforms. We could create our own salons. We could find other channels to continue to tell stories without even having to give up any of our privacy. But we're a little afraid to do that, and I understand that. But there is that possibility that we can get that richness in our lives if we step back a little bit in time, don't you think?
I do. And, you know, you and I are speaking during the COVID moment. And what's interesting about the COVID moment from a communication point of view is how suddenly everyone is being forced under these shelter-in-place situations. Everyone's being forced to do what you just suggested, right? Everyone is sort of huddling together on Zoom or Google Hangout or whatever, Skype, or and having these kinds of intimate virtual conversations. I'm not sure if you can put the words intimate and virtual together in the same sentence, but there you go, right? Instead of taking to these more mass social media, so-called platforms like Facebook or TikTok or what have you. I mean, it's a both-and situation for sure, but I think the teleconferencing has opened up some interesting possibilities for doing what you and I have just suggested be done. And maybe we'll all become a little bit wiser in our use of of social media and our ability, a little more confident maybe in our ability to tell stories in the intimate virtual company of others as we move through this thing.
Well, that's going to be another great conversation that we'll have on Peace Talks Radio down the road a bit when we look back at everything we learned from that experience during the 2020 pandemic. And maybe I'll get you back on then.
Well, this has been such a pleasure. I'm so glad you and I had a chance to do this and to reestablish an old friendship in the ABQ.
Yeah, very good. Rob Williams, thanks so much for joining us on Peace Talks Radio today.
You bet, Paul.